Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Reese Ehrlich, who examines questions now being raised about the Bush administration's failure to find Iraq's purported weapons of mass destruction, the principal justification used for the U.S. war against Baghdad. Yaniv Ikskovitz, an Israeli reservist and co-founder of a group called Courage to Refuse, who explains why he and many other soldiers are refusing to serve in the occupied territories. And Robert Borisage, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future, who assesses the strength of U.S. progressive groups, many of whose members assembled for the Take Back America conference in early June. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The U.S. military has drafted plans to build an execution chamber at the Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba for expected tribunals that would try so-called enemy combatants captured during the war in Afghanistan. The execution chamber and an adjacent death row would become a permanent part of the U.S. base that currently holds 680 prisoners who so far have not been charged with any crimes and have no access to lawyers. Under the rule set up by the Pentagon, President George Bush would identify the people to be tried at Guantanamo before a 3-to-7-member commission. Human rights groups have condemned the proposed commissions and the potential use of the death penalty against enemy combatants. Amnesty International says that the proposed tribunals do not allow for a meaningful appeals process and would allow for the real possibility that an innocent person might be detained, be subject to coercive interrogation, convicted, and eligible for the death penalty. The New Internationalist magazine reports that the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA, treaty has hit a massive wall of resistance in Bolivia, as it has in many other nations in Latin America. During the winter, Bolivia's progressive movements, including peasant and union groups, orchestrated massive street protests against the FTAA that included a blockade of the nation's biggest highways. As a result, Bolivia's president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, opened direct talks with the protesters. Oscar Oliveira, a labor leader who helped lead a popular revolt against water privatization, declared, "We need a new model that respects our rights, one that is participatory instead of secret, all of which is contrary to the FTAA." Grassroots activists are also mobilizing against the dictates of the International Monetary Fund. In mid-February, under pressure from the IMF to cut budget deficits, President Lozada imposed a new income tax on the middle class. Violent protests in the capital of La Paz quickly erupted. 20 people were killed, mostly by military sharpshooters. To restore his credibility, the embattled president fired his entire cabinet and blasted the IMF. As the New Internationalist observes, Bolivian resistance is not just directed at the free trade treaty, but is a battle royale to protect the nation's authentic soul. Citigroup CEO Sandy Weill certainly got the message from environmentalists during an early April visit to his alma mater, Cornell University. Weill, who has come under a cloud of suspicion over Citigroup's role in recent Wall Street scandals, was unnerved by students and protesters from the Rainforest Action Network, or RAN, during his speech at Cornell. At one point, two activists unfurled a banner reading, "Destroying old growth forests is not cool." A few weeks later, just before the bank's annual shareholders meeting, Citigroup called RAN and asked for a ceasefire. As RAN organizer Dan Ferger told the news magazine In These Times, the eco-activist group is in intense negotiations with the banking giant. The end game is to set tough new environmental standards for the financial services industry. It is similar to an effort RAN made in the late 1990s with Home Depot, who were pressured into selling green-certified lumber. Already, Citigroup has agreed to issue a report on the greenhouse gas output of the energy projects it finances. Still, RAN, with its activist principles, is not considering an endorsement of Citigroup as part of any future agreement. As Ferger, the campaign organizer, concludes, "The thing that we keep in mind is that there are ecosystems all around the world and indigenous people living on these sites for whom these concessions are a matter of life and death." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
2 months after the war against Iraq ended, tough questions are being raised in Britain and the U.S. about the credibility of evidence used by President George W. Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair to justify their war against Baghdad. Although the White House claimed that Saddam Hussein's government possessed or was developing chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons was their principal justification for war, these weapons have yet to be found. Officials in Washington and London continue to maintain that the deadly weapons Iraq was said to have had will eventually be found. But leaks from inside intelligence agencies raise the possibility that the U.S. and British governments may have exaggerated evidence or deliberately misled their citizens in an effort to gain support for a war that had attracted deep skepticism. The U.S. and Britain defied the United Nations Charter and overwhelming international opposition to prosecute a war based on the charge that Iraq posed an imminent threat to its neighbors and the United States. Britain's parliament has recently begun an investigation to ascertain whether the intelligence on Iraq's weapons leading up to the war was flawed or simply manipulated for political ends. The U.S. Congress has yet to decide on the scope of such a probe. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist Reese Ehrlich, co-author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. Ehrlich examines the serious questions now being asked about the credibility of the Bush administration's rationale for launching a preemptive war on the nation of Iraq.
You know, every recent war the U.S. has engaged in has been based on lies. The problem is those lies aren't often exposed until many years later. The whole Vietnam War was premised on the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which turns out to have been a complete lie. The North Vietnamese never attacked the U.S. ships, but that wasn't known at the time. What's significant now is that the fighting in Iraq continues, that the war is supposed to be over, the U.S. troops are supposed to be coming home. They're not. The people in the United States are extremely upset. The Bush administration was completely isolated internationally when it went to war, and it's now paying the consequences of that. So the lies that, you know, the anti-war movement and many critics of the Bush administration knew, there was said there were no weapons of mass destruction before the war started. The weapons inspectors from the U.N. said there was no signs of weapons of mass destruction. So this is not new information. What is new is that the Bush administration is now being held to task inside the U.S. as well as in Europe and other parts of the world. So I think it's a very significant development, although obviously the Bush administration is doing everything they can to derail it, divert the issue, say, well, we really went to war because Saddam Hussein was such a horrible dictator, and let's forget about all those other reasons we gave you. So there's it's an ongoing battle, but I think it's seen a rejuvenation of the same coalition of kinds of forces who opposed the war to begin with, and it's a real battle for the Bush administration.
There are formal investigations beginning in Great Britain now about Tony Blair's justification to join the United States in the war in Iraq. Do you foresee similar formal investigations getting underway here in the U.S. Congress, which are dominated by the Republicans? Is that going to be a possibility, given the very restrained nature of the Democratic Party, to put it mildly?
The Congress and the Senate has already announced that they will do an investigation. The problem is that they're trying to short-circuit it from the very beginning. So head of the Intelligence Committee for the Senate said that he wanted a thorough review of all the documents first. Well, that can take many weeks, if not months. So the indication there is that they don't want to have any kind of a real investigation. Some of the Democrats on the committee are saying they want to see hearings as soon as possible. That would tend to throw a spotlight on it. The Democrats, as weak as they are, and boy, are they ever weak on this issue, this is the first one where there's been more than a slight peep out of some of the major candidates and so on. I think they feel that because the war is over, they can't be called unpatriotic or not supporting the troops, so they feel they have more political cover, which just indicates what cowards they were in the beginning, in the first place, to not oppose the war while it was going on, while something could actually be done about it. But I think any contributions, I mean, you know, any CIA guys who want to leak information exposing the Bush administration's lies, that's great. Anybody in the MI6 in Britain that wants to do it, any Democrat that wants to come forward, that's fine. I think it all contributes to the weakening of the Bush administration and exposing their lies.
Do you think the American public is ready for another Watergate-style investigation, if it indeed goes that far, given the enormous stakes with U.S. national security in the post-9/11 era?
The American public opinion is very volatile. If you recall, it wasn't that many months ago when 55, according to the polls now, 55% of the American people opposed going to war unless the U.N. endorsed the action. And then the Bush administration cranked up its publicity machine, and everyone from the New York Times to CNN to Fox TV jumped on the bandwagon, rah, rah, war, and that opinion changed. Well, if American troops are continually being shot and injured in Iraq, when it's clear that that country is not being liberated, that it's being occupied, has the same kind of problems worse in Afghanistan, I think more and more people in the U.S. will see that this was not what was cracked up to be, and that they would be very receptive to a thorough investigation. But like I said before, this is not by any means anything that's set. It could go either way. The Bush administration can rally its forces, can go to the media and make the argument that, hey, these guys are just carping because they opposed the war and they lost, and we won, and let's get on with it, and let's go invade another country. So there's a big battle going on, not only in Washington, but all across the country.
What can you tell us about the cracks that are starting to appear within the intelligence community, both active and retired intelligence officials, who are quite upset by the use to which the CIA and the DIA and all the other tentacles of the U.S. apparatus there were used in justifying this war?
Now that the war isn't won and is not going the way they wanted, and B, that they can't find the weapons of mass destruction, everybody is suddenly pulling out the knives and stabbing each other in the back and saying, hey, it wasn't me. I suspect there are some honest people in intelligence who had their disagreements and stifled it because they wanted to keep their jobs or whatever, wasn't politically opportune to say anything. The one I'm really curious about is, this whole forged document showing that the Iraqis had bought a precursor nuclear material from the African country of Niger. That was cited in not only by Colin Powell in his UN speech, but by President Bush in the State of the Union address, that this was proof that Saddam Hussein was rebuilding his nuclear weapons program. Turned out to be a forged document that was discovered within hours through the very sophisticated methods of using a Google search. That went all the way up to the president. Either you have a series of complete incompetent nincompoops running the CIA and the MI6, or they passed it along saying, hey, yeah, it's phony, but who's going to ever catch us? But either way, it's pretty serious stuff.
That was Reese Ehrlich, co-author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, published by Context Books. Last week, President George Bush met with Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to promote the latest international effort to achieve peace in the Middle East, known as the Roadmap. But not long after President Bush left the region, an unlikely coalition of Palestinian groups launched an attack that killed 4 Israeli soldiers. The assault on an Israeli border outpost was carried out by members of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. A June 10th Israeli rocket attack on a leader of Hamas, which killed 2 civilians, but not the intended target, was roundly criticized, even in Washington. Thus far, Palestinian and Israeli militants have both rejected the roadmap for peace. While violence on the ground in Israel and Palestine threatened progress on the peace plan, the co-founder of a group called Courage to Refuse spoke in New Haven, Connecticut. Yaniv Ikskovitz is a 28-year-old paratrooper and reservist in the Israeli Defense Force. In January 2002, he and a friend organized 51 other reserve combat soldiers and officers to sign their names to an anti-occupation statement published in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. While proclaiming their loyalty to the State of Israel, they announced, quote, "We shall not continue to fight beyond the 1967 borders in order to dominate, expel, starve, and humiliate an entire people." The number of so-called refuseniks has grown to 542. Many of them, including Ikskovitz, have served 30-day prison sentences for their refusal to patrol the West Bank and Gaza. Ikskovitz supports a two-state solution, the removal of Israeli settlements outside of Israel, and the division of Jerusalem into East and West. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ikskovitz about his hopes for a comprehensive peace settlement and who recounts his first military service in the West Bank at the age of 18, which had a profound impact on his moral and political views of the occupation.
We received a military mission to go into a Palestinian village and get someone out for inquiry. We were waking up at night and at 1 o'clock, all through the streets and the houses, and suddenly I started to notice all the features of the Palestinian village, like the smells and the noises and all these kinds of stuff. And it really amazed me, like the normal life of the Palestinians in the village. We reached the house and we spread around it, and we knocked on the door. And the old woman opened up the door, and we went in, we took our man, and the whole family was lying on the floor all together. That's the way they sleep. And there were like 10 children, a grandfather, a grandmother, a lot of mature people, young people. And we took the man that we were supposed to take, and then my commander told me to search the house. So I began searching the house for weapons in the drawers, the closets, and everything. The night after, I experienced a dream that was quite similar to the actual mission, and we were walking in the streets of the village, walking all through the houses. But as we advanced, I started to see that the houses are becoming familiar to me. And these were the houses of my neighborhood. And in my dream, I saw that we're going to my house, to my own house, and arresting my own father. And so this was really a powerful, defining moment in my understanding that what I'm doing is actually coming back against me. In the personal level and in the level of Israel, that what we're doing there is coming right back against us. And I think that this is the meaning of the dream, that denying freedom for others is denying freedom for ourselves.
Do you try to convince other people in your situation to join you to make your movement stronger?
Mm-hmm. Well, basically it's a personal decision. I mean, but we do try to advertise the letter in the newspaper. We do it. We make demonstrations and street activities. We are trying to construct a lot of activities such as conferences all over the universities. We are trying to convince people.
And what's the relationship between your organization and Peace Now and also the group that I believe it's called the International Solidarity Movement, the one that Rachel Corrie was part of, who was killed in Gaza?
Officially, we have nothing to do with them. Not with Peace Now and not with the Solidarity Movement. Many people of Peace Now are refuseniks, and we do agree on the political solution, but officially and formally, we don't engage in any mutual activity.
Do you think that they're serving an important role, people coming in from outside of Israel and Palestine and basically bearing witness and basically risking their lives and sometimes losing their lives?
They're heroes for me. Yeah, if an American or someone from Europe is willing to give up a time from his life for his own interest and come to this very, 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 very frightening place and doing what he's doing for peace, then they're heroes. The Rachel Corrie stuff, then we talked about it a lot because it's a good example of the craziness, the insanity of the occupation.
Sharon is saying he's going to dismantle the illegal settlements. Many people believe that all the settlements are illegal. And is that your position?
Well, my personal position, we don't have like a mutual political position. My personal position is that all settlements are illegitimate, that they are, according to the international law, illegitimate. But since there are so many settlements that became like a city, like Ariel has 20,000 people living in it, so I think it will be very hard to dismantle these, but we will have to give other territories instead.
Do you hold out much hope that the roadmap will be successful in reaching any kind of a significant peace agreement and a just agreement between the Palestinians and the Israelis?
Well, the roadmap is nothing new. You know, Oslo and the roadmap is basically the same. I believe the roadmap is leading to this kind of solution, but the only problem is whether it's going to be implemented by both sides. I think that there's been a slight change in Sharon's position, and the only question is whether he will be determined enough and courageous enough to prevent the settlers from interfering in the peace process and not letting the Hamas achieve whatever they want to achieve, and this is the prevention of peace.
That was Yaniv Iskovitz, co-founder of Courage to Refuse. For more information, call the Courage to Refuse Solidarity Network at area code 202-232-1100 or visit the group's website at www.seruv.org.il. Progressive activists who have been on the defensive since the 2000 presidential election recently assembled in Washington, D.C. for the Take Back America conference, sponsored by the Campaign for America's Future. Some 1,500 delegates came out in early June to attend issue workshops and hear speeches from Democratic Party presidential candidates and well-known political figures such as Jesse Jackson, AFL-CIO President John Sweeney, NOW leader Kim Gandy, author Barbara Ehrenreich, and public television's Bill Moyers. Press accounts of the gathering emphasized what many see as a split within the Democratic Party between its centrist wing, represented by the Democratic Leadership Council, and those on the left who attended the Take Back America conference. In fact, while many speakers at the conference attacked the policies of the Bush administration, criticisms were also directed at the Democratic Party leadership, which many believe have been too timid in challenging the White House on its radical right positions on foreign and domestic issues. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with veteran political organizer Robert Borisage, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future, who talks about the conference and some of the strategies he believes should be adopted to build a new progressive majority to defend human and civil rights and fight for jobs, energy independence, and access to health care.
Well, we thought it was time to bring together progressives from different organizations and from around the country. So we got 20 national partners to join with us, unions, the League of Conservation Voters, women's groups, environmental groups, U.S. Action, and they brought members from around the country. By the end of the week, we had about 1,500 people, and more than half of them were from outside of Washington, as far away as California and elsewhere. And they came, as I said, from different tribes and different organizations, and so it brought a real spirit of people coming together with a serious purpose of taking back the country.
Now, when you say taking back the country, tell us what you view as sort of the project for the coming year with the presidential elections coming up.
Well, I think it's beyond just elections. You know, what's happened over the last two decades is that our politics have been dominated by conservatives. Now the Bush administration has put what are self-described movement conservatives into its administration, and they are driving the policy both at home and abroad. And these are people who are really sundering even bipartisan agreements, turning their backs on 50 years of alliance and building up of international law in the United Nations, on domestic policy. He's given his policy over to really the fiscal extremists, such that even the very conservative Financial Times say that the lunatics are in charge of the asylum. So what we argue is that we've got to build an enduring majority for progressive reform. That's more than just taking back the House or even taking back the White House, although it may start there. It's about building an agenda and a movement and a politics of passion that can transform this country.
The Washington Post wrote of the conference in their June 6th edition, "Progressives Conference Highlights Democrats Split." And then, of course, you had the Democratic Leadership Council that wants to move the party, they say, to the center-right. They said, "We do not believe that the Democratic Party will recapture the White House by simply preaching to the converted in a much louder voice." So automatically you have press and the DLC attacking the conference and its message.
Right. Well, the Democratic Leadership Council really represents no one in the Democratic Party except money. And so when they saw a crowd that included the union base of the party, women, environmentalists, civil rights groups, citizen action groups, they immediately started lobbying memos our way to get themselves in the news story, because that's their trade. And their instincts are always the same and always wrong. Their instincts are to stiff arm and push off any energy that's going on in the society. So they're terrified by the peace movement, which mobilized 15 million people around the world because it may alienate the famous swing voter. And instead of understanding that if you're going to change this country, you've got to mobilize passion and engage people and bring the energy in rather than push it out, they're constantly in the business of division. What I said to the press, although it didn't get very well covered, is I believe that George Bush and his extremism, the extremism of this administration, will unify Democrats in the same way, and independents for that matter, in the same way that Newt Gingrich did in the 1990s. And that when you wage war on workers, you know, when you're against the minimum wage and you're trying to destroy unions and you're trying to take away overtime pay, and you wage war on women and their right to choose. You try to repeal or roll back affirmative action and civil rights laws. You wage this unbelievable offense against the environment. You build unity against you in reaction to you, and that's what the Bush administration is doing. So I think the press coverage was a little bit amiss, and the DLC was really out of tune with where people are and what the kind of energy level was at the conference.
I think there are a lot of people that will agree with you that the Bush administration's agenda will unify many various groups against them. But at the same time, you also have the problem of defining what progressives are for, what the Democratic Party is for. That's certainly been a huge obstacle in recent years.
Right. And that was really the purpose of the conference in some large degree, which is to lay out a very aggressive progressive agenda, to take the gloves off, to put it out there proudly and loudly, to show that it can unify the activist base of the party and is, in fact, reflective of majoritarian opinion in this society, and to argue to Democrats that it's time to stand up and speak out and stop ducking and positioning and being intimidated by this administration. And so we invited all of the presidential candidates to come. Everyone came on the Democratic side except for Lieberman and Graham. And each of them gave, I think, one of their better, more animated addresses with a populist economic core. And if they continue with that message, I think you will see a Democratic nominee who can really make the difference clear between where Republicans are going with their politics that are very much focused on the few and on entrenched special interests, and a politics that works for working people.
That was Robert Borisaj, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future. Contact the campaign by calling area code 202-955-5665 or visit their website at www.ourfuture.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.